Transmitting sound. Download complete. Now launching audio stream. The Kelly Alexander Show.
We're very excited to welcome UK artist Marina and the Diamonds to the show. She has a lot to say about touring with Katy Perry, her love of Madonna and Britney Spears, as well as the ins and outs of her skyrocketing music career. ER physician Dr. Zach Levine joins us to talk about staying healthy during the summer months, including handling allergies and sun exposure. Dietitian Kim Airy is here to chat about kids and soft drinks, and social media expert Patrick Charles talks about tagging music and the big dollars companies are making off this information.
Capture your need for sound.
As we launch into summer in many parts of the world, a lot of us are feeling free and easy, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't be paying attention to our health, even during the warm summer months. Joining us on the show to give us some advice is Dr. Zachary Levine, an ER physician at the Montreal General Hospital. Dr. Zach, welcome to the Kelly Alexander Show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So a lot of us feel so happy in the warm weather and I think forget all about the nasty flu bugs that have plagued us during the winter, but should we still sort of be aware of summer colds?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we can't, it's great in the summertime. People want to get outside. They want to be more active, but we can't completely throw caution to the wind because unfortunately, there's still a number of things that we need to be aware of and be careful of. And one of the things is exactly as you mentioned, these infectious illnesses, including colds and flu bugs, which can happen all year round. They certainly do have a higher prevalence and we certainly are more aware of them in the winter, but they can happen in spring and in summer.
What would be some of the precautions you would want us to keep in mind for that?
So the best thing for most infectious diseases, like most of them are such as the cold and the common cold and the flu, those are transmitted by particles or sometimes, you know, by sneezing or coughing. And the best thing that we can do is really wash our hands. That's the number one way to prevent the spread of these infections. And that's also the reason why the prevalence is not as high in the summertime as in the wintertime is because we're not all in these enclosed spaces as much. So if someone coughs or if someone sneezes, we don't necessarily get coughed or sneezed on. And in addition to that, because of these bugs, if someone, say, coughs or sneezes on their hand and then they touch a doorknob, well, if there are 100 people that use that doorknob during the day, all 100 of them can be exposed to the virus. But if that person who coughs or sneezes, number one, coughs or sneezes into their elbow, and number two, washes their hands, or if after we touch a doorknob, we wash our hands, or we don't touch our mouth, or we don't touch our nose, or we don't touch our eyes, then we won't be passing on the virus or the bacteria that's causing these infections.
So that, just like we always hear, really wash those hands.
Absolutely. Wash those hands. If someone is sick around you, then, you know, don't be intimate with them or don't, try not to be in the line of fire if they cough or sneeze, or hopefully remind them to cover their mouth when they cough or they sneeze. And those are the main things because, you know, these things they're not just airborne. They don't just stay in the air in the sense that they just, you know, if you're walking around, you'll just inhale them. Usually either these particles have to be projected at you, so that means a cough or a sneeze, or you have to touch them on a surface. So like I said, a doorknob is a good example. And then you have to it has to enter your body somehow. So it has to get in either through the eyes or the nose or the mouth, somewhere where there's a mucous membrane that can absorb it.
And do you suggest that people sort of use, you know, that hand sanitizer? Or like, is that like a helpful thing or not? Because sometimes I find people are like super, like they slather that stuff on all the time. And I wonder if their own immune system is like not, it's not helping them.
Well, I mean, I have to be honest, I use that stuff all the time. But of course, you know, I work with sick people all the time, so maybe I'm not the average person. But, I think it's a good thing, especially if you think you may be exposed to some kind of infection. So especially these viral type infections like cold or flu, they tend to be very effective at killing those things. Now, it is important to keep in mind that they don't kill everything. And hand washing, a good hand washing with soap and water is better for certain things, including infections like C. difficile, which a lot of people have heard of, which is a gut infection that a lot of people can catch in the hospital. But if it's a choice between nothing and using those hand sanitizers, then I do think that the hand sanitizers are a good idea, especially if you're in contact with people who may have these kind of infections. As to your own immune system, whether it kind of weakens it, you know, there is certainly good evidence that in kids, you know, if kids aren't exposed at all to any kind of infection, and similarly, if they don't get any vaccines, which because the vaccines actually, most of them act by triggering your immune system to become stronger and know how to react to these infections. But basically, if you're not exposed to any kind of germs in your body, then there is some evidence that your body's not going to know how to handle them. But for most infections, your body can usually fight them just as well. But the key is not to be exposed to them in great amounts. And also, if you are at higher risk, if you're run down, if you're really tired, if you're not taking care of yourself otherwise, then you're even more likely to get one of these infections if you're exposed to it.
Now, what about bee stings or ticks if we're out in the park or in the woods? Because, you know, again, everyone is sort of running free and easy in their shorts and sandals and all that kind of stuff. Is that something that people should really be aware of?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a few different reasons to be aware of these things. And there's all sorts of different insects and bees and you were mentioning ticks, of course, which have become quite famous because of Lyme disease. And, you know, for the most part, to be honest, these are relatively benign things. You know, you get we've all been bitten or stung, and most of them are benign. Some of them hurt more than others. But there's a few things to be concerned about. One is certainly if you know or if you're concerned that you may have an allergic reaction to these things. And I'm not talking just an allergic reaction, because actually, even just if you have the little swelling and redness that we all get, that's considered a reaction. But when I say allergic reaction, I'm talking about what doctors call an anaphylactic reaction. So basically, you get swelling, you get difficulty breathing, and it can actually be fatal. And people like that need to not only prevent themselves from getting bitten or stung, by depending on what they're allergic to, but also they need to carry an EpiPen, which is the same thing that anyone has to carry if they have an anaphylactic reaction to anything, including some people have it to peanuts, some people have it to eggs, some people have it to bee stings. So that's one thing that is certainly very important to be aware of. And then the other thing to be aware of is that some of these insects can carry other infectious diseases. So like I mentioned, the ticks can carry Lyme disease, which is sometimes, you know, people don't know that they have Lyme disease because it can be very vague. You know, the first symptoms of Lyme disease are a rash with like a flu-like illness, and that later on it can develop into other symptoms like muscle aches and fatigue and some weakness and headache. And then after that, it can develop into dizziness and joint pains and arthritis. And so sometimes people can have it for a long time and never know that they have it. So, you know, that's one of those subtle illnesses that is worth being aware of. And then there are other things that these insects can carry as well. And one of those things is West Nile virus, which probably some people have heard of. And basically, West Nile virus and, of course, depending on where you live, malaria as well, those are other infections that are not, depending on where you live, they may or may not be common. I mean, malaria is certainly not common in our part of the world, but in other parts of the world, it's very common. And West Nile virus is not common, but in some cases, it can lead to a very serious infection of the brain and the spinal cord. So you just have to be aware of these things. And the best thing to do, of course, in any of these cases, is to try and avoid getting stung or getting bitten. And the best thing for that is to either, you can, depending on how endemic a place you're in, sometimes you can use mosquito netting and that sort of thing. And otherwise, a good insect repellent is usually quite effective. You know, it's just important to, you know, usually it's benign. It's not, I don't think people have to be always worried if they go outside that they're going to be bitten or stung, but it's probably a good idea to know, number one, if you're allergic to anything, and number two, depending on where you are in the world, just be aware of what kind of potential infections are out there and take necessary precautions.
Can we talk a little bit about exposure to the sun? Because, you know, again, everyone's so excited to be out, especially I know in certain parts of the world. I know, like, for example, where we live in Montreal, it was a bit of a long winter and it's been a bit of a long spring with a lot of cloudy weather. So I think so many of us are just so excited to be outside. But that doesn't mean that you sort of go out there all willy-nilly. So what would be your suggestions with regards to sun? Because I think some people don't realize that they can get sunstroke and all that kind of stuff fairly easily.
Absolutely. So there's two things that I would that I think are worth talking about with respect to the sun. I mean, number one is the sun damage to the skin, which I think, you know, people are relatively well aware of right now. We don't always protect ourselves, but I think people are aware of it. But you know, so I'm talking about the UV radiation. So there's the UVA and the UVB, and the UVB being the one primarily responsible for sunburn and skin cancers, but the UVA as well is responsible for tanning and skin aging. So they both have to be protected against. So the two things really that the sun can do to the skin that we worry about is, number one, burns. Not just because burns are painful, but because burns, if you've had many burns, it does increase your risk of developing skin cancer down the road. And so the thing that you have to do is protect yourself, either with a good sunscreen or sunblock. And it has to be, it's just important to make sure, look on the bottle when you buy it, that it has protection against both UVA and UVB. Because if you just look at the SPF, which is the sun protection factor, that actually just tells you if it's the amount of protection that you have against UVB radiation, which is the one that gives you most of the sunburn, as opposed to the UVA, which is also important. So, I mean, the way to know that is just to look on the bottle, and it will say if it has broad spectrum protection against the UVA and the UVB. Some of them use something called, I'm forgetting the name, so I'll have to look it for you, but broad spectrum protection is, I think, the key word that people use to indicate that it has protection against the UVA and the UVB. And the other thing, aside from sunburn, is skin cancer, and that's something that we really have to be aware of, because even in places like here, where we don't have that many warm, sunny days during the year, in fact, in places like here, we may be more likely to get sunburned because we aren't used to it. Our skin's not used to it. We aren't used to it. And so we just go off into the bright sunshine, and we have exposure to our pearly white skin, and that can get burned. And that, not only is that painful, but it increases our risk of these skin cancers, some of which are really deadly. I mean, there's a number of different kinds of skin cancer, but the most deadly one is melanoma, which is a very deadly type of skin cancer. So you can use these sunscreens or sunblocks. You can also, sit in the shade. You can wear a hat. You can wear some clothing, and there is clothing that actually has SPF or broad spectrum protection. You can actually look at the label. And so that's one thing about being out in the sun, and that is sun protection for your skin. But the other thing that you mentioned, which is very important, is different types of heat illness. And so if you're in the warmth and your body's not used to the warmth, you can become, number one, you can become dehydrated, but then there's all these other things that you can get. I mean, the more mild things are there's something we call heat edema, which is just some swelling of the hands and the feet on exposure to heat. There's something called the prickly heat, which is just a heat rash, which is just a rash that we get on sun-exposed areas. Again, that goes away with just symptomatic treatment. Similarly, some people get some heat cramps. So basically, it's a crampy pain that you can get usually from loss of certain electrolytes like sodium and potassium and some fluids. Again, it responds to fluids. So a lot of these a lot of these heat illnesses really respond well to fluid. So a lot of them are a result of being a little bit dehydrated. So staying hydrated is one way to protect yourself from them. I'll just mention a couple more. I mentioned heat cramps. Heat syncope is when people basically pass out because of the heat. Again, it's because the blood pressure drops, usually because of relative dehydration. And then going up the ladder of seriousness, the next thing is heat exhaustion, which is basically weakness, muscle aches, lightheadedness, fatigue, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, headaches, and muscle cramps. And that is not usually life-threatening, but it indicates that your body temperature has gotten too warm, usually from normal up to about 40 degrees centigrade. And the main thing is to cool down, and you need fluid. Basically, that's the main thing. You need fluid to cool you down and also to replace the fluid that you've lost. But the really bad one, which you did mention, is heat stroke. Heat stroke is basically you have your body organs can shut down as a result of really, really high internal body temperature. So people get confused. They stop sweating because they're not basically the normal body response to being really, really hot doesn't work anymore. And so people often they'll start with serious confusion, and eventually they can lose consciousness and even go into a coma. They'll have a really fast pulse. They'll be breathing very quickly. Sometimes they can even end up having seizures. And this is actually a life-threatening illness. And usually the temperature, people's temperature when they come in with this is greater than 40 degrees centigrade, which is equal to about 105 degrees Fahrenheit. It's very high, basically. And the treatment, this is a medical emergency, and it needs to be treated in the hospital, and the person needs to be cooled down rapidly, and they also need to be rehydrated. And their other bodily functions have to be supported in a medical place. So all this to say, you know, there's no reason usually that we have to get to the point of even heat exhaustion if we're careful. And so by being careful, I mean, you know, dressing lightly in hot weather, limiting physical exertion on really hot days, taking frequent cooling off breaks, drinking plenty of liquids to prevent dehydration. And even before going out, even before being active outside, it's a good idea to pre-hydrate on days like this. And then while you're out there, it's important to continue hydrating. Even if you don't feel like you're getting dehydrated and you don't feel like you're thirsty, you have to keep drinking. And be cautious with things like caffeine and alcohol, because they actually aren't good ways to hydrate yourself. Your body doesn't consider that hydration, because they can actually make you pee, and so you can lose as much fluid or more than you're taking in. So I'm talking about water, and then if needed, other beverages, but not alcoholic or caffeinated beverages.
And what would be your opinion on sports drinks? Because I think a lot of people run to those really quickly when maybe water is still the answer.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not like a purist. I'm not going to say, you know, sports drinks are evil and you can never have them. But in general, certainly water is excellent. If you're doing like, especially most people for what they do, like usually less than an hour worth of exercise, water is perfectly good to rehydrate. If someone's out for a long, long time doing a lot of exercise, then it is worthwhile to have some electrolytes and some sugar and even a little bit of salt in the fluid. Now, whether the sports drinks are the best is a whole other question, because actually the sports drinks have a lot of sugar and probably more sugar than you need. But, you know, I don't think there's real harm. If someone's, you know, really doing a significant athletic event, then water is good, but you do want to replace some of the electrolytes you're using. And so I think, you know, the occasional sport drink mixed in with water, or even, you know, to be honest, probably a diluted sport drink. They probably sell some on the market, but they're not that popular. But a diluted sport drink would give you a little more water and a little less of the sugar, but you'd still be replacing some of those important electrolytes that you do need, that you can lose if you're being active when it's really hot out.
Awesome. Dr. Zach, thank you so much for your time today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Kelly.
That's Dr. Zachary Levine, an ER physician at the Montreal General Hospital, hanging out with us on The Kelly Alexander Show.
KellyAlexanderShow.com.
We're very excited to welcome to the show. I'm going to call her Marina and the Diamonds. Can I do that? Even though I know you have a very gorgeous full name.
Yes, of course you can.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So can you actually explain where you came up with Marina and the Diamonds? I know it's like a play on your actual real name.
Well, my surname in Greek is means diamond, it's the Amanthi, so I just nicked that, transformed it into Marina and the Diamonds. Everyone thinks I'm a band, but I am a solo artist. So
that's a fancy, good, long title to have. Do you feel like you have something to live up to, because it's such a real name, it's like really out there?
It's annoying. It's annoying. I wish I'd just call myself Marina Diamond, but I think at the time, genuinely, the reason for doing it was because I felt like I really like the notion of having a community feel to the project, because that's all it was at the time. I didn't really have any fans. And now I do feel like that. I feel like each gig is, you know, it feels like a club.
Now, can you talk to us about your childhood? Because I understand that you spent different places, like growing up, like in Greece and in Wales, if I understand correctly. So do you feel very like nomadic because of sort of spending time in different countries?
I definitely feel like it's helped with this job. I feel definitely like I'm made for this lifestyle, which is, you know, a different city every day. Because I never really get homesick. It's weird.
That's good to know. That's a good, because a lot of people do like miss where they're from.
Yeah, I'm the complete opposite. I've never been homesick in 5 years of touring.
That's amazing. Yeah. Do you have your parents visit you or family and friends?
Not really. Actually, my mum did come on tour with me when I was supporting Katy Perry. But it's hard because it's, even though there's a lot of downtime, it's also work. So it's hard to have, you know, people with you who you feel like you have to look after. So
now I know that you're a very creative artist, and you mentioned that you had opened for Katy Perry. Did you learn a lot from her, or was it like also like a more of an eye-opening experience for what she's about, because she is crazy with the costumes and stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it was good to see a pop show done properly, because I'd seen all of her peers do these kind of arena shows, and you know, as I'm sure you know, you might have seen similar shows, it really ranges from terrible to like all right, and then Katy is like fantastic. So I get, you know, I kind of got why it was so successful.
Now I understand that you have a love of Britney Spears. Can you talk about that?
I grew up with her. She was, you know, a huge star when I was about 14, and I think I just really connect to her as a person. Like, my favorite artists are her and Madonna, and I love Madonna. I love her as a personality. I love her as, you know, someone who is really brave creatively, whereas Britney is the opposite. She's very manufactured. And though I'm sure, she did have a say in a lot of things, I think I liked her story, like everyone else did. That's why the press followed her.
I would love your take on Madonna, because as a younger artist that's coming up, I work in Top 40 radio, and I can tell you that a lot of fans write into us saying, you know, Madonna's over the hill and it's not, you know, time for her to go. And then when they see her sort of very skimpy ensembles that she, like, even at the Billboard Music Awards, which were recently, they're like, why is this 50-year-old woman doing that? Yeah. Can you explain how you feel about her?
So true. Well, how I feel about that is... it's fantastic, because I saw her in the news, I think it was like 5-6 months ago, where she like got her boob out in a show. And I was like, that's the most punk thing you can do. You know, it's like a 50-something-year-old woman where society deems you shouldn't be sexual at that age, and she's doing it. So I feel like she has the power to do really, empowering things. And you know, why is Madonna going to change at 52 from what she was at 30? There's no reason. Her personality is always going to be like that. So, I don't know. I see comments like that, though, too, and they're like, oh, she's over the hill, whatever, whatever. And I think, well, she's had a pretty good run so far. So, and she looks great.
Now, talk to us about your stage show. What do you want your fans to take away from it?
It's very satirical. The whole project was like... centered around the idea of a pop star and using that pop model, you know, the whole like Stargate Luke co-writing process, and applying that to myself, and you know, I suppose trying to make my own way or make sense of that world. So for the show, it's kind of a visual representation of that. It's very camp and ridiculous.
Can you
theatrical?
I love that. Which would follow in a vein of Madonna, because she really likes to put on a show.
Yeah, it's actually. I was thinking last night when I was performing in Toronto that it's actually much more in the vein of theatre than of pop.
Can you talk to us about your sound? Because sometimes, like, I've read a lot about you and I've listened to your music. I find it interesting when people try to explain how you sound. Ugh. So I would like you to explain how you sound.
I don't know.
I put you on the spot.
Confused identity. Well, my first album was all over the place. There was some like rock indie stuff. There were ballads. There was also like pop 80s new wave sounding songs. And then this one is quite cold electronic pop album. But as a writer, I don't know what I am. I identify myself as like a lyricist and someone who has, you know, a distinctive voice. So I think production always, it directs whatever label you're going to garner from music press. So I think I'll probably change identities for every album. People always say that I sound like something else than what I am.
Can you explain your writing process? Like, do you need the words first? Does the melody come?
Always the words.
Is it hard to write the music around that?
Yeah, I would never sit down and just write the track first, like the instrumental, ever.
That's really interesting, because I really love speaking to artists and see where they come from, because some people like have beats first or the melody and then they write the lyrics around it. And I always love to feel like where you come from. So you need to sort of know where you're going.
Yeah, I mean, with lyrics, I usually collect them over periods of time, and then if something starts to make sense, well, there's this, an issue in my head at the time or a theme, then I'll sit down and we'll just literally pick the first lyric and put my hands on a chord.
Do you write the title first too? Like, does that come to you or does it come through lyrics?
Yeah, sometimes, especially for electro art, actually, like Bubblegum Bitch, Homewrecker, Prima Donna. Actually, Prima Donna, I had the idea for 4 months before I got in a studio with Dr. Luke. And I even texted him. I was like, I've got this great idea, Prima Donna. And I knew it would be like an important song for me.
Who would you like to collaborate with, whether like producer-wise or like artist-wise? Like, would you love to work with Madonna?
I would love to. Yeah, I would really love to. Just have to get her to be a fan of me first.
I'm sure she would be. I feel like if she loves Lady Gaga, she would love you.
I think she might.
I think she would totally love you. I think she would love your realism.
Yeah, I think we would get on as personalities at the very least.
And maybe she'd try to pick up your accent.
Maybe I'll try and pick up hers.
Can you talk to us about your album Electro Heart? Like, is there a running theme through it, or is it like a collection of songs?
Actually, don't want to be depressing, but I think death has like a huge part in it. Actually, when the album first came out, a Dutch journalist was like, "Is Electro Heart a suicide note?" And I was like, "You are spot on."
That's awesome.
Yeah. What else? Well, there's a lot of satire about love in it. Identity is a very big theme as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, where do you see yourself going in the next couple of years? Like, I remember I interviewed Lady Gaga sort of right when she was coming out, like 2008, like just when Just Dance, you know, and she was fascinating because she knew exactly where she was going. And I believed her, even though, like, you know, she was just out. So where do you want to go?
I don't know. I feel with this third album now that I can't be bothered to try and guess or to try and plan, because I've tried that before. And it's interesting that you say that about Lady Gaga, because every artist is so different. Like, when you look back at big artists now, at the time, you know, whether they were big or small, you just, you know, you would never know, you know, that XYZ would make it to this stage. Like, some artists, you know, that people kind of cast them off in the beginning and they actually grow to be really long-term artists. So who knows? I'm definitely one of those people who I can't plan anymore.
And how important is social media to you? Like, do you enjoy reaching out to your fans? Because I find, like, I know when I was a kid, you know, you'd write a letter to someone and hope they got it. But now there's like a real chance that you might see it and respond, like through Twitter or Facebook.
I think even less so, because there are so many replies and also so many weirdos that I actually don't look at my mentions very much. Maybe once a week top. Sometimes I'll go a month without looking. And I do just want to, I have said to people in interviews, well, if my fans are listening, don't at me. Or like, don't waste your time doing that. Go outside and, you know, do something worthwhile. Twitter is great for voicing your opinion, but let's face it, that's all it is. It's kind of a narcissistic social media tool.
You are fascinating. I just have to say, I love getting your take on this, because so many artists that I've talked to, like, they are obsessed with it, like obsessed, and even like Google search their name.
Really?
Yeah, so I love that you have a healthy respect for it to sort of put it in its place.
Totally. It's gross. It makes me feel gross. Does it mean, like, it's just like being on the internet for hours and you're like, I've just wasted 3 hours.
Yeah, I know that for a while, because being a radio announcer, we're supposed to keep up with everything. So, we, you know, we're following you. We're following all the, like, Madonna. You have to be up to date. So, but I've come to a healthy place too now where I'm not completely obsessed with it. But I do have two accounts. I just thought I should mention that.
Good, yeah.
Yeah, I have a personal and a work one.
And you know, the worst thing is, you know, like you're saying, it's your job to keep abreast of things. It's like, this isn't news. This is artists just, you know, saying whatever comes into their heads or retweeting compliments about themselves. Why do we have to read that? It's like...
I know, that's interesting. That's fascinating. Now, last thing before I let you go, what message would you like to send out to your fans? Because we know you don't like to tweet them back. So let's just... is there a message you'd like to say?
I do tweet sometimes. But, well, just to be smart and hilarious, as they always are. They're incredible. I've met some incredible people on this tour.
Well, Marina, we wish you the best luck. And thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you. Prima donna girl, yeah. All I ever wanted was the world. I can't help that I need it all. The prima donna life, the rise and fall.
You say that I'm kind of difficult, but it's always someone else's fault. Got you wrapped around my finger, babe. You can count on me to misbehave. Prima donna girl, would you do anything for me? Buy a big diamond ring for me? Would you get down on your knees for me? Pop that pretty question right now, baby. Beauty queen on a silver screen, living life like I'm in a dream. I know I've got a big ego. I really don't know why it's such a big deal, though. Someone else's fault. Got you wrapped around my finger, babe. You can count on me to misbehave. Prima donna girl, fill the void up with celluloid. Take a picture, I'm with the boys. Get what I want, cause I asked for it. Not because I'm really that deserving of it. You say that I'm kinda difficult, but it's always someone else's fault. Got you wrapped around my finger, babe. You can count on me to misbehave. Prima donna girl, yeah. All I ever wanted was the world. I can't help that I need it all.
One of the nicest things to experience is having a nice cold drink on a hot summer day, but not all cold drinks are created equal. Do we really know what makes up the juice, soft drinks, and flavored water we drink? And how does this affect our children? Do soft drinks affect child obesity? Our dietitian Kim Airy joins us to discuss how some summer drinks could be affecting your children. Kim, welcome back to the Kelly Alexander Show.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me, Kelly.
So, Kim, soda drinks are often, and I can say this from firsthand experience, I often enjoy having a little Sprite on a summer day. Can we talk a little about what's in soft drinks?
Well, there's mostly a lot of sugar in soft drinks.
Damn.
And some soft drinks come with an enormous amount of caffeine. And that's where we start to get into trouble, because the caffeine can then be addictive. And of course, we also know the sugar can also be addictive. So between the two, it's a bit of a conundrum for us.
Is the darker colas the problem, or can there be just as much caffeine in a Sprite as in a Coke?
No, lighter drinks tend to not have any caffeine. And the exception, though, is Mountain Dew, which
okay.
is, you know, pretty high in caffeine,
yeah.
actually usually higher than colas.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah.
a good thing I gave up drinking that then.
Yeah.
Can soda really, though, have a negative impact on kids? Like, obviously, if it gets out of hand.
Well, I think that's the issue. That is a that is the biggest issue. I mean, I know I'm going to date myself, but I can remember when I was a kid, my grandmother would take an 8-ounce bottle of Coke and she would split it between my brother and myself, and we were perfectly happy with our, you know, half a Coke each. And as a big treat, she would make us a Coke float, which again was a half a Coke with some ice cream. I mean, that was like, you know, wow. Mm-hmm. And this would maybe happen once a week or even less often than that, right? It was on the visit to grandma's or, you know, somebody's birthday or something special. Whereas now it's an everyday occurrence. I mean, families sit down and they have the 2-liter bottle of whatever right on the table. And it's a part of our everyday life. And the other issue is that, you know, children are used to getting handed a 750 milliliter bottle of the stuff and assuming that that is a portion. So part of the issue is portion distortion, like we have with just about every other food we eat in North America, where we've, you know, why do you need a 32-ounce soft drink? Why do you need 700 milliliters of something?
Right.
Doesn't even make sense.
That's a lot. Now, I wanted to ask you as well, especially because, well, you and I have talked about this in the past, but like I am a huge proponent of water when people or kids are exercising at sporting events, whether it's a game or, you know, a track and field meet or whatever. But I find that oftentimes, I think it's getting a little bit better, but I know for a while it was very much like, oh, bring soda to, you know, the game and give them that, or lots of sugary juices. Does that actually impede them? Because I can't imagine it helps the kids.
Well, actually, the issue is that I would say it would depend on how long they're exercising for.
Okay.
If, you know, it's the one soccer game that they're playing and they're getting, you know, their 1 hour or their hour and a half. And again, depending if they're running around the whole time or if they're, you know, going on and off the field, water should be probably fine for them. Where you might want to get into something that's more like a Gatorade or something that's got some sugar in it, like a juice, is when they're going to be exercising multiple hours. You know, if you're exercising more than 2 or 3 hours, then you're going to be having significant energy loss and you need to replenish your energy. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be having also significant electrolyte loss, like lots of sodium and potassium that you're going to lose in your sweat, which could cause cramping. So what you want to do then is replenish that. Then at that time, you can maybe reach for a sports drink or possibly some juice.
Okay. And what would
you say? The best thing, though, the best drink for recovery, especially after game, has been found to be chocolate milk, which is a bit of a surprise.
I love chocolate milk.
Yeah. Well, it's got the calories and it's got the nutrition.
Right. Yeah. I often have I usually have about a 250 milliliter glass after I go for a half hour run.
Exactly. That's perfect.
And is it
That's
true,
perfect.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about that, just now that we're on that subject. Is it important when you do, let's say, whether you're doing a half-hour run or you've, you know, played soccer for an hour, that you get that chocolate milk into you within 25 minutes? Is that true? That's what I heard.
Well, again, that's typically really important when you're going to be doing prolonged activity. When we're doing a half-hour run, I hate to say this, but man is built to do that. And that doesn't, unless it's a really, really intense run, like a sprint for a half an hour,
right. It's
not likely to be enough that you really need to do anything to recover from it afterwards.
Okay.
So you really need the recovery when you're doing prolonged activity, which is considered to be more than an hour and a half to 2 hours of activity
in
a row.
Now, would you advise that, let's say they are at a soccer tournament and they've got 3 games in the day. They've played, you know, one in the morning, one in the early afternoon, and maybe one later in the afternoon. Do you want them recovering with a juice, or is it better for them to have, not to mention that they've had their lunch and all that sort of good stuff, but is it better for them to have like an orange slice, or is it better for them to have a juice?
Well, we like them to have juice because the juice is going to be absorbed more quickly and it's going to get to where it needs to go more quickly. The minute you start eating solid food, it takes longer to digest and it takes longer to get to where it's going. Also, sometimes we want to keep it fairly liquid depending on how long it is between games, because you know how hard it is to go compete when you've got a full stomach, right?
Right. Okay.
So we usually like to have at least an hour and a half between when you eat and when you're going to be competing. So at that point, depending on how long they've got, you're going to want to keep things fairly light and liquid, but fairly nutritious.
Joining us on the Kelly Alexander Show, our dietitian, Kim Airy. You can find out more information on Kim on our website, kellyalexandershow.com, but also on hers, kimairy.com. Kim, is it possible for kids to become addicted to soft drinks and, you know, the sugary juices?
For sure. And we know that just ingesting sugar triggers the same pleasure sensors in the brain as other things. So for sure that could happen. We also know that becoming addicted to caffeine is also very possible in adults and in kids. I think one of the things I read about, and I was actually quite horrified, is there's a woman in New Zealand who actually passed away from drinking cola, and because she was consuming 8 liters a day.
Oh my God. That's disgusting.
And it was just an overdose from too much caffeine. And we have to understand that children, being little, it takes only 2 to 3 soft drinks a day to reach their peak amount of caffeine versus understand that there's going to be caffeine in their chocolate and caffeine in, you know, different places. Mm-hmm. So we really have to be careful with the amount of caffeine we're giving them. That's one of the reasons why you want to stay away from a lot of the energy drinks, because they're really high in caffeine. And that has been linked to, in some young people, an overdose in caffeine and serious heart problems and even death.
Can we just briefly sidebar for just a second, just because, again, we are coming into summer and you know, lots of kids running around. Again, can you give your thoughts on sports drinks when kids are just doing the regular amount of running around, not at a soccer tournament or not at a baseball tournament that's going on all weekend? Like, if they're just running around for an hour, do they really need to be ingesting energy drinks?
No.
Okay, that's good. That's
no,
good.
They really need to be getting some water. If you want to give them some diluted juice, because they kind of go, yep, you know, the water, I'm tired of drinking water, mm-hmm. Dilute your juice.
Okay.
To give them something that's got a little bit of taste to it. If you want to give them something that is more flavorful, I've got some clients who will take the juice and they'll put 2 bottles of juice to 3 bottles of water and kind of, you know, mix a kind of a punch up that way. Mm-hmm. Or they'll, you know, they'll do different things like that to get them something. But they don't really need a sports drink. We've got to remember sports drinks come with a lot of food coloring. And there's been some recent studies that are linking food coloring to attention deficit issues.
Oh.
I know that a long time ago that was an issue, and then it kind of went out of vogue, and now they're kind of, you know, looking at it again, and they're saying, well, maybe. So something that you want to use with discretion and not pretend that kids are just little adults and they can just handle what an adult can handle. Remember, those drinks were developed for adult athletes.
Yep.
Who are, you know, we're playing football in Florida.
Exactly.
That's why it's called Gatorade. It was developed for the Florida Gators.
Awesome. This is why we love having you on the show, Kim. You keep us all straight. Now, here's the big question. They've all been big questions, but this is the big question that I think a lot of people have in their heads or the back of their minds. Is soda and or juice linked to childhood obesity?
Well, actually, we know that for the most, they just did a study in the U.S. where they found that actually 70% of the calories from added sugar that are in the American diet are coming from bread, jam, cakes, and ice cream.
Huh.
So I'm not so sure. I think it could be on a case-by-case basis, we might be able to say, yes, it does contribute. I think there's other things, though, that we're finding that are really great contributors to childhood obesity, and one of them that people don't address is lack of sleep.
Right.
And we know that lack of sleep plays a huge role in children developing obesity. And, you know, maybe the reason they're not sleeping is because they're drinking the cola beverages, which has caffeine in it, and they're not, you know, that's playing a role in their sleep habits, and that maybe can be part of the problem.
Okay. Now, how can parents or adult figures, because I know, like, you even just talked about it yourself, that, like, grandma used to give you, like, some Coke, but I think that that's fine, like you said, if it was in moderation. But how can, you know, parents and or guardians help their kids make wise decisions when it comes to the sodas and the juice boxes?
Well, I think first of all is they have to go back to the idea that these are treats as opposed to the best way to get nutrition. And I think that's kind of a bit of a shift in how we're thinking. So because they're treats, for example, the juice box only goes in the lunch box on alternating days or every other day or you know, once a month or something, or with the special Friday lunch when you send the, you know, the pizza or something,
mm-hmm.
So that you make those kind of, turn it into something of a more of a special occasion as mm-hmm. opposed to a something that's ordinary. You want it to be in the, I think it's important with kids to kind of expose them to these things. One of the things that I've seen in some children is when they're not exposed to them at all, then when they become adults, they kind of go overboard and really consume it in,
right.
in huge quantities. So you want to teach them the place it can have in their diet, which is a once in a while thing.
Gotcha. Perfect. And I wanted to just ask one more question, I guess, based off of that. So you yourself are okay if the kids know, let's say, like Friday lunch is treat day?
I don't actually see a real problem with that. I think treat days are fun. I think we want to understand that I don't like the concept of cheat days where you gorge yourself on everything that is not, you know, you kind of save up for a whole week and you eat like, so I have clients who do this, that, you know, they save up for a whole week and they're like so pure it would make, you know, I don't know how they do it. And then, you know, on Saturday, they start like in the morning with two eggs, bacon. Then they go to their favorite fast food restaurant. And it's like a gorge all day on fast food. No, wow. That's not good for you. But to once in a while say, I'm going to have something a little different, something that's got, you know, a little higher in calories, something that's a little treat that's out of the ordinary. Why not?
Perfect. Kim, thank you so much as always. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So if you have any comments or questions and want to learn more about Kim, very simple. Check her out on her website, kimairy.com.
Capture your need for sound.
If there's one thing that's changed in the entertainment industry in the past 5 years, it's the social aspect of it. Millions of people are sharing what they're watching and listening to, and that information is worth big dollars, B-I-G. Joining us on the show to talk about all of this is our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. How's it going?
Magical. I am great. I'm very excited to talk about this because, you know, like 6-7 years ago, no one was even really talking about social stuff at all. It was still sort of blogging was the thing. And now, you know, it's just exploded. So, you know, why does the industry want to know about all of this, the social aspect of things?
Well, it's interesting because especially for television, you know, for years they've gone by Nielsen ratings, right? Which are basically families that have a box plugged into their TV. There's like 50,000 Nielsen families, and they use that to figure out what the ratings are, what people are watching. So like, you know, one household will represent like whatever the ridiculous number is, like 14 million people or something. So the share points for the shows depend on how many people have their TVs on a set channel or what they're watching and if they switch and that kind of stuff. So that's what advertisers have been basing their info on. But lately, they've been noticing that a lot of people are tweeting and Facebooking about shows that they enjoy. And there are shows that don't have massive ratings, but at the same time, you'll notice on social media, you'll hear about them all the time.
Now, when we talk about, I guess, tagging music, tagging advertising, what are they doing with all of this data?
Well, it's interesting, again, because this data is way more useful to them than what they used to use in the past. Because, I mean, it's authentic. I mean, people are volunteering the information. So rather than just saying, oh, you know, we estimate that about this many people are watching this show, this way they actually have people saying, hey, I'm watching this show. One of the first ones that I noticed personally when it came on TV was The Voice. Now, The Voice is doing really well. They've always had solid numbers. But the thing I noticed was that so many people were talking about it in real time as it was on TV. And that's what they call second screen viewing, right? Like mm-hmm. people have the TV on, but they also have an iPad on their lap or a phone in their hand. And they're, you know, texting and tweeting stuff about the show they're watching at the same time.
I am guilty of that. I do that a lot for music award shows or award shows.
Yeah,
I get caught up in it. And it's funny because you just said it, like I sit there with my iPad and like I'm off to the races. And then I notice like, and I kind of feel like my day job as an announcer, it's sort of part of that. And not that I think I have, you know, great insight over any other person, but, you know, it's what we do during the day. So if we're talking about, you know, a music show or a music award show and you sort of know some of the backstory about why that person is doing that performance or whatever. And I mean, it's very easy to also get negative Nelly, like, why are they wearing that? You know,
of course.
I try to stay away from that. But you see a lot of people either doing that with those types of shows or also if it's like a season finale, a series finale, or even hockey.
Oh yeah, for sure. I mean, for sports, it's a really big thing, and people have to avoid it. If you're PVRing a game, you have to avoid Twitter because you might see, oh my God, did you see what just happened? He scored. It's 5-0, and you don't want to see that, right? But I mean, real time information is what people are sharing while they're watching stuff.
And how does this translate, I guess, into, because obviously companies want to sell this. They want to make money. They want to figure out a way to get money out of this.
For sure. Well, it's crazy because for one thing, I don't know if you know about Shazam. A lot of people use Shazam, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And that is basically for identifying music. I'm not sure how many platforms it's on. I guess it's on iPhone and Android. I don't know if it's on Windows Phone or anything like that. But basically what you can do is if you hear some music, you don't know what it is, you open up the app, hold your phone up to the speakers, and it'll tell you because there's an audio fingerprint on like everything that's ever been recorded, basically. Mm-hmm. So what's great about Shazam, people are using it more and more all the time, and they make a lot of money out of it, and I'll tell you why. It's because they actually get a percentage of digital sales. And the way they do that is they get a single-digit share point, they say, a single-digit percentage point from every iTunes sale because there's iTunes links in it. So if you identify a song, it says, hey, that's the song by, you know, Moby. So it gives you a link and it says, would you like to buy the song from iTunes? Now, the amount of people who actually do that, they get a cut from it. And last year, they estimated that they made about $300 million in digital download sales.
Wow, that's insane. And is it just Shazam or are there others? Because I'm a Shazam user. I just really haven't investigated other apps.
Yeah, there's SoundHound as well. SoundHound is pretty good, but they're both incredibly quick. There have been a lot of comparisons of the two services, and they're about the same thing. I mean, it's just a question of preference, I think. Uh-huh. I don't think there's much of a difference as far as what they can do.
And those things like are amazing. Like Shazam has never turned me wrong. And it was funny because I was actually in this store, this outlet, like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and I didn't have Shazam yet. And I wish I did because there was this song that the store was playing in, you know, like in the jeans store that I was in or whatever. And like I searched high and low for that song. And I was like, if I had Shazam, it probably would have, because I Googled the lyrics that I could remember from it.
Sure.
It was just a disaster. But like Shazam is awesome because it's never been wrong for me. Even like remixes, it seems to get right sometimes.
Yeah, it's really incredible because especially as we've gone towards digital music, I mean, people are better at tagging things than ever before. When I say that, I mean, the industry is better at putting that digital fingerprint
right
on every track. And what Shazam has launched recently for the iPad, I don't know if you've updated your app, but now they have this sort of background constant tagging.
Oh, I didn't know
that. So if you're watching a TV show, it'll just be saying, oh yeah, by the way, that song in the background, it's this.
Oh,
and you'll open up the app and it'll show you.
That's awesome. And I wanted to ask you as well, in the grand scheme, what are people tagging? Is it just music stuff or is it like everything?
Well, people are tagging everything. I mean, television is becoming more and more of a popular thing to actually tag and to check into, I should say. Like people are saying, you know, I'm watching this, I'm watching that, or they're commenting on it. But one of the things is it's good because for the TV shows, when they put cool music on their shows, basically, because a lot of stuff gets broken that way, right? A lot of bands get an obscure song on a TV show and people start talking about it. What was the song at the end of Grey's Anatomy? What was the song on this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So people get excited about that. And that's good for the TV shows, of course, because people go to TV shows now as a source for finding music.
So the TV shows, are they benefiting from all of this in the grand scheme as well?
Yeah, definitely, because the whole industry is like feeding itself, because what's happening is people are finding cool songs on TV shows, then they're watching the TV shows even more to find more cool songs.
Okay, fantastic. Well, Patrick, as always, thank you so much. We really appreciate your input each and every week here.
Thank you. I'll see you next time.
Awesome. That's our social media expert, Patrick Charles. Again, you can find out more about him on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com. And also you can follow Patrick on Twitter at GetPatrick. A big thank you going out to my guests this week, including Marina and the Diamonds, Dr. Zach Levine, Kim Airy, and Patrick Charles. As always, I want to leave you with your thought-provoking quote of the week, this time coming from Stephen R. Covey. Most of us spend too much time on what is urgent and not enough time on what is important. Don't forget to follow us on social media, on Twitter, at KAlexanderShow, on our Facebook page, The Kelly Alexander Show, on our website, KellyAlexanderShow.com, as well as our YouTube channel with tons of interviews, youtube.com/KellyAlexanderShow. If you have any comments or questions, email me, Kelly@KellyAlexanderShow.com. Have an awesome week. You and I will chat soon.